It's unusual I get to completely geek out on a comic book film during the awards season, but no real surprise considering what a true anomaly Logan is as it managed to smartly buck convention at every turn. Howdy, I'm Jeff Goldsmith and this is the Q&A. My agenda is simple. Each week I plan to bring you in-depth insight into the creative process of storytelling. And wow, oh wow, oh wow, this was a dream episode to do because Logan is such a great flick that had so much thought put into its script along with some excellent direction that it was a real treat to have co-writer-director James Mangold in the screening series to sit down and discuss his film. You know, it's really wild to think about how much he got away with in this film as he basically upends the norms of a franchise in order to truly honor it. Look, fans love Logan, critics love Logan, and you're gonna love hearing Mangold talk about his creative process, so I know you'll dig this episode. And speaking of things to dig, this episode is sponsored by ScreenCraft. Are you writing a screenplay? The 5th annual ScreenCraft Screenwriting Fellowship is open for applications. The ScreenCraft Fellowship is one of Hollywood's top programs for discovering and launching emerging screenwriters. All of last year's winners signed with industry literary managers, and ScreenCraft offers winners the opportunity to mentor with Academy Award-winning screenwriters and producers, studio executives, agents, and managers. This year's fellowship deadline is March 1st, 2018, and you can enter any and all ScreenCraft writing programs and competitions in 2017 and 2018 with the exclusive 10% discount coupon code QAPODCAST. All one word, just enter QAPODCAST for the discount. Remember, ScreenCraft is dedicated to helping screenwriters and filmmakers succeed, so please check out screencraft.org for more info. And while you're surfing around online, I hope you'll check out my digital magazine Backstory on the iPad. It is the place to go for amazing television, film, and theater content. Now, folks, one of the cool things I'm able to do in Backstory is something I call post-publishing. That means even after we publish an issue, we could push new articles into it. So if you've purchased issue 29 or a subscriber, just open it up every now and then and check back for updates of new articles as we post-publish them into the magazine. And we still have a few other ones floating in as well, like a great one for Thor Ragnarok that we're not going to release until the film comes out in theaters because we focus so much on some of the film's bigger spoilery sequences that it wouldn't be fair to release it any time before then. Remember, issue 29 of Backstory is our Blade Runner 2049 issue, and I simply can't wait for you to be able to read it. And don't worry, you'll be able to read every single issue of Backstory at www.backstory.net soon because our servers have been transferred and now we're just in final testing and design and we're even working on it during weekends now, so stay tuned. Right now, as you know, Backstory is available on iPads as the Backstory app. It's also available on Android tablets via Google Play. Just look for the Backstory app to find us and you have it. Now, not only are there great articles on Blade Runner 2049, but we also covered the original Blade Runner with interviews with Hampton Fancher and David Webb Peoples, so don't miss that. We even had Jason Isaacs, the star of Star Trek Discovery. We have articles on the horror film It. We had Danny McBride and David Gordon Green on TV's Vice Principals, and so much more. So I hope you check it out. And of course, don't forget to check out screencraft.org as well. But now, without any further ado, let's jump right onto the stage of the Los Angeles Film School right after I introduce co-writer, director James Mangold to chat about his latest film, Logan.
It's gonna be a tough interview. I'm all broken up.
Oh, pull it together.
I mean, come on. Is he really gone? All right. Well, so we're gonna start spoiler free for a while, and then
Everyone saw it.
They saw it, but okay. for the podcast listeners. But of course.
Okay.
So I just want to kind of give people a baseline for you because something that I've always found is kind of interesting was that in 1985, just going back a few years, you managed to have a writing deal with Disney.
And you
got a movie out of it, and you co-wrote on Oliver and Company, and I'm just kind of did not expect that happy reception for Oliver and Company, but it's great.
Joel fans.
Yes. I'm just curious, kind of at that young age, your entrance into the industry. What were some of the important lessons that you learned? Because before we get to Logan, we're just going to talk about some of the lessons learned. So, what were some of the things that kind of came up on those projects that era?
Well, I was kind of the wet dream of every film student in the sense that I got out of CalArts in 1985 and immediately, based on the short films I had made, got signed by a major agency. The chairman of the agency got signed by Disney at that time. Eisner and Katzenberg had just taken over Disney and were looking for young talent for the studio. And it was an awful experience, actually, for me.
Why? Why was it bad?
Because I wasn't ready. Because in a weird way, I mean, one of the things I'm always sharing when I go to film schools is that everyone's in such a damned rush to make it. But if you don't have the arsenal to kind of defend your ideas, you can get there too early. And I think I did. I mean, I think I had some measure of something that they spotted, but I didn't have a lot of scripts under my arm. I was 21, and I found myself in a situation that I had contempt for. I didn't like the way they made movies. I didn't like the way they seemed to be developing them. Every time I pitched them an idea, it needed to be like something else that came out that year, and I found it all kind of intolerably annoying. And I found myself kind of on my ass after a year, meaning I couldn't find a way to connect. They put me on an animated movie basically because I think they thought it was a good place to work me off my deal. And and ended up after a year kind of on my ass, banging around L.A., trying to figure out what to do next. I wrote narration for trailers. I wrote a Christmas special for CBS, but I kind of Easter special, actually, and the claymation Easter race. But the
nice.
Yeah. But and from Wet Dream, I became the ultimate film school nightmare. I am now 22 years old and unemployed and without any future.
But that was when you went to Columbia, right?
Well, a few years later, I toyed with becoming a novelist. I was so disillusioned about movies in general that, I mean, Disney also fired me from directing a TV movie that I had directed for three days. And then
why?
They thought it looked too dark. I was trying to make essentially that, which surprise. I was trying to make something like The Red Balloon, and it was not a lot of language in it. It took place in the inner city. They wanted shows about suburban America, and I think that's where I really ran afoul of the executive corps there. And they pulled the plug on the movie. They moved me off to animation. And then several years later, to make a long story short, I ended up going to Columbia for the simple reason that I asked myself as I was living in North Hollywood, a block or two from Circus Liquor, that...
which is still there, by the way.
Still there. I asked myself when I was last happy, and when I was last happy was when I was in film school. And I was desperate enough that I thought, well, just do that. Like, you're lost. Go to where you were last happy. And rebuild from there.
And often, you know, when somebody gets a deal and they start working in the industry, the last place they would go to film school. But I really admire that you did. And when you went to Columbia, I think
film school gets a bad rap. I think it's really cool to put it down. But I think that it is whatever you make of it, frankly. And for some people, that's shit. And for some people, it's awesome.
Well, we're sitting here at the Los Angeles Film School, and I'm curious what your experience was, because you had Milos Forman. Like, you got to study under the great Milos Forman.
I was very lucky both places I studied. At CalArts, I ended up as a teaching assistant, and Alexander McKendrick was teaching there, and I became
right.
I attached myself immediately to him, and then at Columbia I was lucky enough to study with Milos, and a bunch of other great faculty members were there, but I also had, you know, the one thing that film school is, any school is really, is also time out and to work, you know, and where you're not having to necessarily justify why you're not having a full-blown career at that moment. So, and when I got to Columbia, having already been in the business, having already kind of had a whole lifetime happen once, I was very industrious, and I wrote what became my first feature, Heavy, and also what became my second feature, Copland. Wrote both of them at that.
Both great. And you finished them both while you were at Columbia, before you even graduated.
The script to Heavy I wrote at Columbia with Milos's help. He was like, I would send him pages in Connecticut every weekend, and he would just come in and give me notes, and I'd keep working. And the script to Copland, actually, is an anecdote for anyone here. What I brought in to my screenwriting class, and everyone told me was shit. And so I never finished it there. And I finished it after I left.
You kind of have to listen to your own instinct.
You do.
Obviously.
Ultimately, ultimately no one can guide you but you.
Because you have to make the movies that you want to see, not what the committee wants to see, unless they're hiring you and that's the deal from the beginning.
Yeah.
I'm curious, just do you remember kind of any eye-opening notes that Milos gave you or a way that he showed you to look at filmmaking differently?
Milos he said several things that stay with me and that I quote and think about all the time. One is, he would say often to us, don't tell me 2 and 2 is 4. I know 2 and 2 is 4, and meaning don't make a movie where you're telling me 2 and 2 is 4. If you're going to make a movie that tells me that good people do good things and bad people do bad things, or that if you work real hard, we know all those stories. Tell us a story that surprises us. Like Milos would say, the opening of your movie should say to the audience, 2 and 2 is 5. And then the audience goes, no, it isn't. And then your movie is the proof of that theorem. You go about proving something they do not believe and trying to convert them to something they do not believe, as opposed to what too many movies these days are, which is telling you what you already know and want to hear and just reaffirming it for 2 hours. And that in some way trying to find a new angle on your story was essentially his advice. The other thing was just that I was a really messy writer. I can't outline. I don't like to outline. I hate the look of my movie in any kind of beat sheet. I think it just reads like bullshit when I look at it in that form. So I tend to write in full screenplay and try and figure out my movie at the same time. And most screenwriting teachers were like, you can't do that. And that didn't work because I couldn't do it their way. And Milos didn't care, and I just wrote script. And I would send him reams of material I was writing. And then one day he came in and he said, you see this on page 47? And I said, yes. He goes, that's your movie. And it was, if you know, none of you will know my first movie, but it was the scene in this movie when Shelley Winters, the mother of the lead in my first film, dies, and he comes back to the restaurant they work at, and he doesn't tell anyone that she's died and pretends she's still alive. And that he was like, that is the incident of your movie. That is what it will be about a man who denies that his mother's died and pretends she's still alive. And the lie will keep your entire movie alive, you know. And I built the script off of his confidence, really, and then went away and made it.
How soon after film school did you make your first film?
Well, master's, I mean, it was kind of like, I don't know if it works the way here, but master's program at Columbia is kind of like people dribble out. It's kind of like they're half in and half out of the school sometimes. So I went there 2 years kind of full time and then finished the script and then went about trying to get the movie made, but didn't really. I think they graduated me based on Heavy. So I kind of just was hell-bent to get the movie made, more than I was worried
about.
But
so how many years after school did Heavy get made?
Well, it came out in 97. I think I was technically at Columbia 4 years, but I think I kind of paid for 2.
Okay.
And kind
All
of hung around.
That makes sense. That's a good way to go.
Yeah.
You know, getting to tonight's film, and I've interviewed you in the past. I love the Western work that you did on 310 to Yuma, the remake, and obviously Walk the Line was awesome as well.
Thank you.
And you could see tropes of those things in tonight's movie, which we'll talk about. But I guess the easiest place to stay would be 2013's The Wolverine, which you directed. What were the lessons that you learned about getting into the comic book genre and specifically working with Wolverine? Because you had a dry run for this.
Well, Wolverine was a project that I kind of came into. They were already exploring it. Darren Aronofsky had been exploring making a movie out of the Japanese saga. Then he bailed on it. And there were other people they were talking to, and then it kind of was on and off. And I came on, and I was I'm kind of crazy for Japanese films. So there was this, and I've known Hugh forever, since 2001, and there was a kind of very innate attraction to what was attractive to me about that movie was taking a kind of superhero film and moving it into this kind of foreign landscape. And even foreign language, I had a great time making the movie, but I didn't feel like I made my movie. I felt like I made one of those movies, and it had pieces of me in it. But it was when it came, when the conversation came around to making another film with Hugh as part of this series, I was pretty disinterested in it, unless it was going to be a film that was my film that just so happened to feature that character, as opposed to, I don't know how to explain it other than I don't think these universe movies are really movies. They're very expensive TV episodes of a.
Well, it goes with the anthology nature of comics in general, in which it's a continuing saga
of
sorts.
I think it's its own interesting semi-political topic, because the comic books reinvent the characters all the time
and kill them off
and redesign them I find it's always really interesting because people are real film fans, and then they're also really angry if the movies ever deviate from each other. But in a way, they're also – it's a contradictory goal, because you're not going to get expressive and interesting films if you're asking the filmmakers to live by a kind of immovable Bible and semi-religious Bible, even the innovation that happened in comic books happened because new artists came and reinterpreted these characters.
As a screenwriter on any adaptation, invention is important, because if
absolutely.
You're too dogmatic, it's dead on arrival.
Well, it's not a movie, meaning that a movie, to me, should have a first, second, and third act. It should have a beginning, middle, and an end. It shouldn't be a continuation of someone else's work, or else it is effectively an anthology, and it's not a movie. I think, I made this film with the goal that if you didn't know Wolverine, you could watch this movie. I think that should be, I'm kind of a classicist, but I think anyone should be able to walk in on any movie and watch just that movie. You shouldn't have to do homework. You should be able to watch that film, and then it operates on its own as a story. And
on 2013's Wolverine, you did have a director's cut, which is interesting, because a lot of these don't get a director's cut per se. What was important to you about your director's cut? I mean, I know the violence levels were a little different.
It was not much, to be honest.
Right.
They were selling Blu-rays. But the
was that it? Was that it for the director's cut?
Well, it was that we kept paring down the violence for ratings, and at some point, I recognize that the fans are going to be bummed out, because there's a kind of when you make Wolverine movies, you particularly come in contact with this. But one of the really unique biases of the MPA rating system is that it's built kind of on a porn standard, which is that penetration is the worst, so you can't see that. So guns, because bullets are invisible, you don't see penetration. So you can shoot as many people as you want and kind of be PG-13. But if a knife goes in a body, that's penetration and is R. And so you're making a movie about a guy with knives in his knuckles, you're really boned. And so it becomes really hard to somehow stay under that boundary because of that. And that would be why I think we released a special one.
Well, was there ever a time in your career before Wolverine where you were going to circle around a comic book movie? Or was that it? Had there been other times?
There's been times I've tried several times to, in terms of even hanging with Neil Gaiman and working on it, was Sandman.
Okay.
And I still would hope someday that could happen, but we never know.
It would be amazing if it could.
Yeah.
You were talking about ratings a second ago. I was going to talk about it later, but this is an R-rated movie. And, it's unrelentlessly R-rated, which fans really appreciated. And I want to know if that was always the plan from the beginning, because I heard a rumor that I would like you to verify or deny, in which it wasn't 100% go that Logan was always going to be rated R, and that when you were shooting it for the first few weeks, you were doing alt takes just in case, and then Deadpool came out.
That is such horseshit.
Is it horseshit? Okay. Because
yeah.
The rumor goes that Deadpool came out and it didn't find.
Well, first of all,
and then they said yes.
First of all, if wherever, whatever bullshit website got this rumor published, you'd go, just line it up, because Deadpool had been out before we ever started shooting.
Okay,
so
good.
The timeline doesn't even fucking work. But
shot it down. That was exactly what I wanted. So from the get-go,
it was rated R. It was contractually rated R.
Good.
I was only making the movie, it was rated R. We had to make the movie at a budget that was significantly lower than we had made the previous Wolverine or any other, because it was rated R.
So what was the budget?
Just over 100.
Okay.
Yeah, which, these X-Men movies and Justice League movies and all these things cost well, I mean, 200 is the baseline.
Just to give people a sense of the numbers, you made it for $100 million. It grossed domestically $226 million, $390 overseas for a cum of $616.7 million worldwide. So congratulations on that one, buddy.
Thank you. I mean, what's really heartening about
you proved
that,
yet again that there is a mature audience for these movies, and that rated R comic book films are welcome.
With a pretty bleak ending, too. I mean, the reality is that it, you know, I don't think anyone expected the response, even I, commercially, but the part that was really satisfying was just I'm really proud of the movie, and I felt like Hugh is one of my great friends, and I felt like he wanted a way to get out that of the story in a way that was also fitting to the 17 years he had spent playing this role. And part of that ambition that I have to credit to him, the bravery of it, was not trying to do another, but doing something radically different. And that's also the part that surprised me about the success of the film, because the whole kind of aesthetic of the film is runs very counter to what's going on in superhero movies, in the sense that it's not fetishizing a lot of equipment. No one's got outfits that you can write articles about.
There's
no
not a lot of logos. Men.
There's no new vehicles or gizmos to chatter about. There's no new guest villain from the RSC wearing a wild wig and contact lenses. There is a kind of very intentional effort to put these characters who had existed on a kind of epic plane just in the back seat of a Datsun and driving them down a shitty road. And, you know, my greatest moments of pride seeing this movie are kind of just the simplest scenes of just like Hugh beating the shit out of that pickup truck with a shovel or something, where it could be, you know, because the inspirations for me making the movie were films like Paper Moon or Little Miss Sunshine or The Wrestler, not superhero films.
Yeah, Little Miss Sunshine with Blood, exactly. Yes. Well, so I'm curious when you first came across Mark Millar's Old Man Logan, which is the basis for this, and what your thoughts of it were, as this is a loose adaptation of sorts.
I wouldn't call it that. I'd say inspired by might be more fair.
There you go.
Inspired by the world of it. The trick with Mark's story is that it was kind of it itself was a kind of inspired by of kind of Josie Wales and kind of other elements of the West that he kind of took and spun. But the aesthetic was really inspiring to me. The storyline itself was kind of impossible to do. Because it involved a myriad of characters we didn't have rights to.
Well, right. It's the Hulk family is who they're against.
Yeah, but also it wasn't the story I wanted to tell, meaning it was kind of a guest star around every corner movie in terms of superheroes, and I'm kind of over that, meaning I kind of think to me, is less about being a movie and more about just, oh, look who's here now, and it's more about a kind of different kind of fans' satisfaction that I'm interested in.
Was there ever anything about the Hulk on the table in which studios sometimes share characters the way Spider-Man went from Sony to Disney?
No.
Nope. Okay.
I mean, the biggest thing for me is if you want to make a character-based film, what is the biggest thing that stands in the way? You look at the other films of this ilk and you go, why is it? It's not just like, I'm really good or they're not. It's much more simple. It's like, how is the building being built? How is the screenplay written? So that it facilitates it being a character film. I mean, what is the difference? You know, this movie isn't built on any idea that New York City or North America or China or the planet, it will be destroyed if X or Y doesn't happen. It's built on relationships and the movement of relationships. And that is a fundamental thing from the screenplay up. But if you want to make a movie about characters, the other thing is you can't have too many of them. And what I think, it's kind of one of these double-edged swords that fans like these movies riddled with these characters, many of them, but at the same time they find them shallow. But that goes hand in hand. If you have ensemble action movie that's 2 hours long and it has eight characters and there's three or four major set pieces of action, take out the set piece of action, you're left with maybe even 45 minutes. Then you have that 45 minutes, you divide it by seven or eight characters. Each one has an arc less elaborate than Bugs Bunny would have in a cartoon. So, because you just don't have the physical real estate or
the
bandwidth.
Low character count essentially focuses the story around those characters.
I mean, it's just obvious. It's like you have the same amount of time, but now you're exploring three characters instead of 11. And that just means that instead of everyone getting a mini bullshit arc where they're angry at someone in Act 1 and they have a little mini scene where they're a little less angry or more angry in Act 2 and then they come to some kind of denouement in Act 3, it's actually a story about people's relationships and the complexities of them, because you're not doing this kind of abbreviated thing, which is not due to someone's lack of skill, but it's his lack of real estate when you're packing a movie that full of M&Ms.
I only asked because Wolverine's first appearance was in a Hulk comic, and it was kind of cool that old man Logan had the Hulk family involved. But, you know, kind of moving on to your influence.
I hear you. I'm just not – that's not
it would have been a totally different movie, and I love the movie that you made.
Yes.
Moving on to your influence, you know, Shane obviously has a weight and influence to this movie.
Sure.
You have the movie playing on a television during the movie. It's the final line she delivers over Wolverine's body. Tell me about the influence of Shane and when you realized you were going to go, honestly, that far with it. Because I could see a trope, but I mean, you went full Shane, my friend.
And I went full Shane.
And it's beautiful.
It came about several different things. One is just about the time I was finishing the previous Wolverine, I got the chance to present a restored print of Shane at the Academy. That was a few years ago. And and watched it several times in preparing what I was going to speak about the film. I had always loved the film. But I also, the Western informs the cleanness and the kind of, there's a kind of honesty to the Western that I don't think exists in comic book movies that often. And I wanted to bring the kind of prism that I at least get, speaking for myself, from watching Westerns and samurai films and other forms to this. Like, for instance, the hero's ambivalence about their duty, their ambivalence about their fame, their ambivalence about their notoriety, their ambivalence. The one of the built-ins, because of the kind of, and by the way, I enjoy these things in other people's works, but one of the built-in ideas in a lot of comics is this kind of fetishizing of the brand, of the insignia, of the uniform, of the utility belt and the vehicles and all that stuff. But all that, if you ask real character questions as a writer about what you're writing, is about someone who's very involved in branding and being known and wanting to make sure that whatever act of goodwill they commit is somehow labeled so everyone knows who did it. And it was Coke, not Pepsi. You got it? And so that to me, I find that all troubling and weird and worth exploring. Like, what was interesting to me was to take the Western ethos where, like, Shane doesn't want credit. Josie Wales doesn't want credit. He doesn't go around going, Josie Wales was here, or leaving. It's kind of theirs. He spits. But the reality is that the signature of these characters is a kind of ambivalence about their heroism that I personally find much more appealing and less suspect, and that and less self-serving, and that the I wanted to see what happens if you bring some of that idea into the milieu of a comic book film.
Well, right. He has the adamantium kind of killing him from the inside out. He's not apt to help a woman in distress. Like, he's the typical, I don't want to be involved, cowboy who prefers his solitude, and his dream is to get on a ship.
Well, because it never ends. Like, I mean, one of the things I feel about, one of the weird ambivalences I feel about the movies we make is that particularly the tentpole movies we make, is that we kind of construct a situation where the world is in one dire fix after another, and then through a series of amazing miracles by amazingly miraculous beings, the world is rescued. And I feel like our world is in a lot of trouble, because it seems like we're all expecting or waiting for that person who's going to come in and straighten our shit out for us, and I don't think they're coming. I think it's up to us. And I don't want to participate in making more anesthesia for people to feel like the earth that we're fucking up and the guns that we're toting around and the violence we're encouraging is all going to be solved by some magical person from the North Pole coming down and teaching us the right way to live. That it's really – and if I were Logan, I'd be like, fuck y'all. You can't figure your lives out. I can't go. There's too many fires. You like the pain of being a person like that. What I immediately imagine is there's too much suffering. It's like if you could hear everyone screaming for help at once, every 911 call, which one do you pick? Where do you go? And when do you stop? When do you sleep? When is it not your job anymore? Those are interesting questions to me. And when do you let people suffer on their own? And when is your gift a burden?
I think all those are valid points, and that's why this works, damn it. You know, I'm curious if you how closely you worked with Kevin Feige, because it's always
interesting. I've never met him.
Never met him. Okay, so he is just not involved with the Marvel side for Fox as much.
No.
I've just always wondered that, because he used to be. There was a time where he was. It was a long time ago, but okay, good. You never met him. I want to talk about your habit for a second. We talked about it earlier, but obviously you were talking earlier in your career. Talk about your habit for outlining now as a writer and the importance of it. And when you were sitting down on Logan.
I can't do it. I'm telling you, I still can't do it.
You still just burn out pages.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, obviously I'll take notes about but if I start writing like some abbreviated version, like Logan walks in, sees a guy, turns around, blah, blah, I already hate the scene. Like I hate the scene. It's dead. It's inert. To me, the writing an outline creates stories that feel like they were made in an outline, meaning you make bigger shit happen in the scene because it's too boring in a kind of logline paragraph. I feel like my work tends to operate on a series of kind of micro struggles or kind of concerns that you don't need. You're not going to find it writing abbreviated versions of scenes. You're going to find it writing the scene.
Same question, different angles. So do you at least know your beginning, middle, and end if you don't commit it to paper
Sure.
before you start?
You have a sense. You can't. I mean, like, yes.
Because some people know their end.
I'm not advocating not knowing anything and sitting down.
Some people know their end and they reverse engineer their screenplay to get to that point. So is that a trick that you do? Or, I mean, surely you knew that Logan was going to die.
I think out. I don't completely discover my movie in writing it full. It would be some kind of act of stream of consciousness, but I know where I'm going or what we knew Logan was going to die in this movie. I knew I wanted to, like, I had in my head what I could describe to you, which is that I wanted to make a movie in which Logan is taking care of Charles Xavier. Charles has a kind of dementia that has made him dangerous. They're living on the hinterlands of the world. I had this idea that he's an Uber driver, and you get this kind of collection of humanity flowing through this limo that he drives. And to me, there was kind of this sexy idea that what they'd end up taking off in was a limo and kind of racing across the country in this damaged limo, which is kind of probably some tribute to Eastwood's The Gauntlet in that bus.
Really? That's funny.
Yeah. Right. But it was like that. So then I'd sit down and I start writing a kind of taxi driver opening of Logan driving a limo, and I'd have those pages and I'd put them aside. And then I wrote a first scene, pretty much the one that's in the movie between Charles and Logan in the tank, the very first scene, which in a weird way is outlining, because you, through the dialogue and the scene between them, I'm figuring out what's happened before, what's happening now, what their situation is. And then I start building off what I have. And sometimes I'll write, like, I need a scene here where blah. But I don't ever do the kind of hand me a 3-page version of the whole movie. I can't do it.
Great. When you sit down to write, how long do you write? Do you give yourself a certain amount of hours, or do you give yourself
a page
count?
No, I go until I stop. But
okay.
My biggest advice about writing is that most people, I think, including myself, when you are stuck writing, is because you don't know what you're writing. And so you shouldn't. You should go see a movie, go for a walk, hold hands with someone, go to the park, go on a hike. And when you think of something to write, find your way back and write it.
Clear your head.
Well, no, know what you're writing, meaning there's nothing worse than sitting down to write and you don't know what you're writing. That would be like picking up the phone to call and you don't know what you're saying. It's of course going to produce a moment where you're like, because you need to arrive. That's why when you're really pissed at someone and you write them an angry text, it flows like fuck, right? Because you know what you need to say. So what you always want to do is get to a place with a screenplay where it's like you're really pissed off at a friend. And and then you suddenly have written 22 pages and you won't know what happened. You know,
and they're very angry.
Good.
Yeah.
Better than not.
As long as you can wrangle it back over to the story and the character. Your habit as a director, how important
You have an agenda. I can't meet your agenda.
I do not.
No, not as long as you wrangle it back to the character. You just fucking write.
Okay, I only say that because you write. I only point that out because you write such character-driven pieces.
Yes, yes.
So
but
that was my only point. There's no one way to do it.
There is no right way. Right. To me, the key is to have the energy to write, meaning that the greatest failure will happen by not typing. So whatever gets anger, tears, joy, hilarity, whatever gets you writing, write. And then, yeah, sculpt. Sculpt and find what's valuable in what you did.
How long did it take you to get your first draft?
Of this? We didn't figure the movie out until a couple months before we start shooting it. To be honest, I think that there were ideas. I mean, the biggest – I had kind of written the front end of the movie as I had kind of been coming up with the story. The back nine of the film, there was kind of a breakthrough in January of 2016 that was in New York with between Scott Frank and I, which was this idea – which we thought someone, not Kevin Feige, but someone would stop us from doing, but this idea of the comic books existing in their world. And
which was very meta, and I really liked.
Yeah, thank you. But it was really a breakthrough for us because it was a way to kind of put on screen his own ambivalence about his legend. And at the same time to create this kind of agenda for Laura that she's trying to get to the place she read about in these comics, and he's going, they're bullshit. They're bullshit, you know, and that to me was a really rich place to explore. Not that he was saying nothing had happened and that he wasn't Wolverine, but that whatever we were was turned into something else, and a commodity, a Happy Meal, an action figure, whatever it was my own way to kind of slap back at where I felt the tentpole industry had gone awry.
For the podcast listeners, because there's just no way to avoid spoilers anymore, I think there's no listener in the world that doesn't know this is Wolverine's final movie, but we're going to get way more in depth. So if you haven't seen the movie, press pause. You're talking about Scott Frank, you know, great screenwriter. Michael Green also has a credit on this.
Yeah.
And I want to hear how you worked as a director with both of them and at what points they were on it or how long they were for. Did you and Scott write together?
Yes.
Did Scott go do his own draft?
No, Scott and he has worked with me as a solo writer, and we wrote, but we are great friends, and we wrote together on this. I wrote the story and kind of got what was really effectively the first half of the script, kind of, I don't think you'd call it screenplay, but I call it scriptman. There was dialogue written, there was a lot of description, it was probably 40 pages and just 50 pages, half the movie. And I knew where it was going, where we were headed, the border, this kind of run, all of that. But I thought it was flat in the second half. There was a point at which Michael came on and was helping me trying to carve our way there, but we ended up going in a very different direction in the back half of the script that he helped refine what was in the front, but I thought we kind of were going – there's a kind of gravitational pull on these movies where you end up – if you don't resist, you end up writing another one of those movies, you know, and suddenly the White House was involved and blah, 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 and I was like, holy shit.
Well, wait. Actually, it's really interesting to hear because since you didn't do that, give us a glimpse into what the version was that you didn't like. What were some of the left turns you were taking?
It was the political and the epicness that you kind of just start as you're trying to increase the stakes in the second half of the film, you start reaching for bigger gestures and bigger action, and suddenly there's fighter jets or the government is in this big, and you're going like I just knew we had made a mistake. There was a point at which we were kind of whatever my own feeling about what we needed to do, we were betraying the kind of the core intimacy that the wrestler can't be the wrestler in the front end and then turn into Transformers. It has to be the wrestler all the way to the end. And that as with Shane or anything else. So then at that point, Michael went on to another project and I wrote alone, and then Scott joined me, and Scott and I met in New York for about a month and really hammered out the back half of the script.
In that left turn phase, or just the discovery phase, if you will, what were some other versions of this movie that were kind of in your mind that were never even, you know, shot, obviously? Just some other early iterations that would be just interesting to hear about your thought process.
Well,
one
of the things I was most fascinated with was the idea, and one of the things I first asked myself as I was working on it was what is Logan scared of? Meaning, if this is his last movie, what we should be facing him with is what he's most frightened of. And that the answer was love to me. So that kind of shaped the whole franchise of the film, the sense of family, the sense of confronting him with a daughter, all of that, and responsibility for her, all of which would be far more frightening than a tank with a bazooka on it. And so that But one of the other things that was very interesting to me was the burden he carries of what he was as Weapon X. And that in a way he is kind of like Shane, like other gunmen in Westerns, he is living out a present with a past as a bad man. And that Logan, and one of the things I think that's never been able to be, never been explored in the previous Wolverine or X-Men films, partly because of real estate, is just the darkness of what he was. He was a villain. He was a killer. And that, so one of the things I had been exploring early on was actually kind of having him plagued by memories of coming back to him of the atrocities he had committed. That in a way he was running from his own villainy or running from his own. And that was really interesting, but it became the solve for the movie, became kind of the present tense of creating a kind of Weapon X in the movie that, like a nightmare, was coming back and committing those atrocities in the present. Because what I found is we were, as many of you screenwriters here would know, once you get involved in flashbacks and forwards, you kind of suddenly end up with spaghetti very quickly as a script, meaning it's a very tricky proposition to find your footing when you're moving hither and to in a script.
You were talking a second ago about the usage of the comic books, which was very meta and cool. And you know, the opening big page splash says Eden or the End. That's nothing that's ever appeared in a comic. Was there ever a sense of using some of the comics that fans would know, or was
we
there?
We couldn't.
Okay.
It was one of the very real when Scott and I came up with this idea in New York about using the real comics, we obviously wanted to use kind of the golden period of the X-Men comics and Wolverine comics. But one of the things I immediately had Fox Legal look into is what did we have the rights to use? You know, like they have an option to make films about the X-Men and other ancillary Marvel characters, but how far does that extend? And what I discovered is they don't actually have rights to show the comic books. The comic books are still property of Marvel.
That's crazy.
So we just hired Marvel artists and created our own.
They look beautiful.
They're done by all the people who did the Marvel comics in the 70s and 80s.
You know, another writing question for you. There's so much action in this movie. I'm curious what advice you would give to writers for writing action on the page. You know, there's two ways to look at it. Some people have described it as there's the pre-production draft to get funded, which needs to be sparse and not as detailed. And then there's the production draft where you really need the details so that the crew heads, the different departments get a better sense of what you're doing. Was that your process? Or tell us what you did.
No, I think you should just be sparse and never do anything more. There's enough other ways to plan stuff without. My theory about the text in a script would be that if you were sitting in this theater watching a movie with a blind person, then you were describing what they see on the screen, and you only have as long as the shot takes to get the description out. Because then you gotta fucking move on, because they're gonna fall behind, and you're gonna fall behind telling them what the movie is, and that. So the second you're going, the cumulonimbus clouds shaped like the buttercups of a blah 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 blah. Shut up! Are we caressing the clouds for a minute and a half in this movie? No. So stop talking about them. Do that later, or just get on with it. Tell the story. Try to tell the story in the speed with which you could describe it. Live.
But getting a little more into the nitty-gritty, they're in the limo, they're trying to escape the compound, they get caught in the fence. The fence then starts dragging behind them.
Screenplay writing. So
you went that deep.
Logan gets behind the wheel. His foot jams on the gas. He says, "Hold on." The fence approaches. The tires dig in. They hit the fence.
So you're beating all that out.
Well, of course.
Okay, I'm just making sure.
I mean, how else would you write it?
Well, because there's
lots of stuff happens. We'll solve later.
No. But there's a thing in the movies where lately with these, especially the tent poles, that they sit with storyboard artists and previs for so long that it starts changing the shape of the script.
Well, sure. Certainly everything changes. I guess everything changes the script. Meaning, even the rehearsal on the day you're shooting the scene. Even
of course
the editing. So. I'm always revising the script, but that at some point in prep, the script becomes only one of several documents that are really important for us. But that the the first thing I was saying is what I subscribe to, that, yeah, it's very important. Like the, like that moment with the fence you're describing is was really important to me because it was more than just a piece of action. It was a piece of action saying how this movie was different. That was going to help every, meaning that you rev a car and run it at high speed toward a chain link fence and it doesn't burst open.
Which was great. And then you have the train like a true Western. So, I mean,
right. So that the, all those elements are scripted and obviously they get refined as you're on location or you're beginning to sketch out how the action's going to work. But I also don't think that belongs in the script. Like, I don't need to know he's looking left to right. I don't need to know. It's really incredible the exercise and how little you need to know. And at least my experience as a screenwriter is that part of the reason you write too much when you start writing is because you want to make the movie and you can't make the movie, so you start making the movie on paper. But that you shouldn't. You should be writing a recipe for making the movie, and you should be creating. And also the primary experience you want people to have is the experience of momentum, which they will hopefully have watching your movie. And the way you're going to create momentum is less bullshit. So there is less stuff between the stuff. So the less all that description is not momentum. It is a kind of frozen picture. And so how the exercise of getting to the next beat where something happens or there's sexual tension or violence or anxiety or sadness or fear, and how I don't get lost with filigree that is inert.
Momentum is a great way to describe it. You know, how many pages was the production draft when you finally had
130.
130? Okay. Yeah. I hate to geek out for a second, but I have to. Just gotta ask this question. Obviously, there was a timeline reset in X-Men Days of Future Past, which Simon Kinberg wrote, and you know, he's the producer of this film as well. And I'm just curious, where does this fit in the timeline? Because in X-Men Apocalypse, there was a different Caliban. And I'm just curious if this is an offshoot, a different timeline.
I have no idea.
Oh, excellent, excellent.
I mean, as you can tell, by the way, yes. I'm sparring with you on these questions. I don't care. Meaning that I think that stuff is in the way of making good movies, not in support of it.
Sure.
It is a kind of, it would be as if I'm making movies for the Catholic Church and I have to pass some kind of papal approval for what happens to Jesus in this episode, and that the it's just ludicrous. And so
I'm just curious where it fits in.
I know,
that's the only question.
But you're part of the industry when you ask those questions of maintaining the sense of, did you break canon or stick with canon, when in fact I think canon sucks.
I was just trying to figure out where it was in the canon.
Nowhere.
Okay.
The reality as a marketeer would be that we very carefully positioned it beyond all the existing movies. So it's up to you. You
right.
come up with it. Meaning my feeling is I want to have a relationship with the audience, not with internet crazy fact checkers with 100 episodes of shit accusing me of getting something wrong. It's the actual audience that I'm most concerned with, and that they exist in the immediate, taking in the movie. And unless it's wildly contradicting something that they just saw in another movie, it's not of concern to me.
From a place of character, why would they trust Caliban when he helped hunt down the remaining mutants? I was very curious if there was something deleted about their kind of alliance that we find them in.
Because I think there's a point we get to in the story where mutants are so estranged and living on the fringes of the world, and only, I mean, the supposition in the movie is that there's no new mutants being born, so the only mutants are kind of mutants over 45, so that they stick together and maybe have forgiven one another. I mean, there was a point I even imagined Magneto in this movie, but again, I was kind of like thinking it's too many.
Interesting. What was he going to be doing in it?
He'd be in some form of disrepair. Like, I love the idea of all these characters in a kind of twilight, you know.
Just falling apart, yeah.
It's like the Sunshine Boys with Marvel characters. To me, that was instantly exciting and interesting, and I'd never seen it. And that's I mean, it's partly my own arrogance or whatever kind of spiciness with you about these questions is how you get the movie made. Meaning it's so easy. It's the gravitational pull between the kind of internet industry of superhero movie worship, the actual industry itself of selling these things, the merchandising machine, the toy manufacturer, the comic books, the rival companies, the summer dating, all of it is not a friend to movie making. That's a friend to kind of just corporate money making. And that part of my own defenses to make a movie and not just a commodity is to have a lot of hostility toward a lot of the value systems, some of which fans bring to the material, that where they're actually serving corporations, not themselves, in my opinion. They're actually demanding the movies work as a box set so that they all can then be bought and sold, so that the action figures will work consistently from one movie to another, so that the animated Saturday morning one can match the... They're actually demanding something that helps the companies sell and ram all these products at the same time. It's much harder for the companies to make money off 8 different visions of what Batman could be, 8 different visions of what... But for me, phenomenally more interesting.
I was going to say, sir, I love that. I love that comment. Well, and that's why this was so out of the box, and why fans reacted so well to it, because they were presented with something new, which is what we've needed for a while. But so I love the idea of Charles's brain, one of the greatest minds in
coming undone.
Well, in degenerative brain disorder, and having these seizures, be it ALS or Alzheimer's, like you said. When did that idea come about?
Well, those are the ideas. Like, that's the kind of outline idea, Jeff, that happens to me, which is I kind of go, what would happen if, like you take, what if I take this father figure and who has the world's most powerful brain, and then, you know, I'm living in the world like all of you, we're all living longer, kind of dementia and Alzheimer's and all these issues are really prevalent in a lot of our lives. And I go, what happens if those issues come to play in one of these fantastical worlds? Charles isn't immortal. So what happens if the world's most powerful brain, what happens to any of us when we start to lose the thing we're best at? And that's a really interesting place to dig.
Well, it's just show-stopping moments in which, you know, at the Oklahoma casino, you're just stopping the movie as he's having, you know,
a seizure.
And
but it's
also
kudos to Patrick, it is really rich stuff to play. You were once kind of king or the chairman of the board of this elite squadron of heroes, and now you've lost it, you know. And I think one of the things that's so interesting in the heroes' lives, sporting figures' lives, military figures' lives, these conquerors and heroes at the point when their bodies can no longer sustain their self-image, and that produces really interesting stuff.
It almost even seems like a self-defense mechanism at that point, because, you know, there's people with a gun to his head, and he goes into...
Well, that's what he also claims with Logan in
right.
The later scene, that's what he was doing, but Logan doesn't believe him.
You were talking about flashbacks earlier as a possibility, and I'm curious if you ever had a flashback of what happened to the Academy, because it's mentioned a few times.
I wrote one.
What was it like?
It was distracting, because it immediately... would have me, you know, you'd be asking me who was in it, who died.
Well, everybody died clearly, but
well, no,
right?
You're saying that, but to me, again, my whole thing is trying to avoid the trap, the frankly journalistic trap of getting into, like, I think it's why our country doesn't get anything done, is because we've constructed this thing where every time you propose something, people find a way to unwind you and get you on your heels. And the thing is, like, yes, I had written this, but the second I would put it on screen, I could see that the movie would be about, what, you did that to her? Well, why didn't, blah, 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 and half the answers would be, we couldn't get that actor, or we could get that actor, or we could, or we don't have rights to that.
It just would be showing an interesting way for this movie that's the final film of Wolverine to be reunited.
All I can say is, I wrote the script that way, and it was distracting, meaning it made the movie about X-Men and not about these characters.
Interesting.
And so my sense was, how do you do this like Tennessee Williams would write it? How would you do it? Like, there's a tragedy back there, but it's back there. We don't have to see it. Just because there's death and traumatic things doesn't mean it's the big open. Because, again, the wrestler isn't going to have a big open. Little Miss Sunshine doesn't have a big open. So what happens is you find yourself writing that scene and going, fuck, I did it again. Now here I am at the Academy, and there's a disaster, and it's a big open, and now it's an epic movie, and who did this? Now we have all these questions, and now I'm going to be at Comic-Con answering these questions for the next 3.5 fucking hours. And I don't want to. And it's like, I want to make a movie about these few characters, and how can I construct the movie so that it not only focuses me, but keeps the marketing machine and the whole machine from getting distracted on this kind of very profitable system of chattering about all these character histories.
Ooh, hey, I'm cutting in really quick to remind you all about my digital magazine Backstory. It's an iPad magazine that focuses on the art and business of storytelling. Currently, we're an iPad-only magazine and also available on Google Play on other tablets, but fear not, we're coming to the web very soon. You could check out www.backstory.net for updates. As I said earlier, our servers have been transferred, we're in final testing, and it's all looking really great, so you will finally be able to read Backstory on the web very soon. One important thing to remember about Backstory is that when you subscribe on the web, you'll get access to every single issue we've ever published, so you'll be in the loop on everything. My team has put a lot of work into our new issue number 29 with Blade Runner 2049 cover stories that include in-depth interviews from writers Hampton Fancher and Michael Green on this utterly fantastic marvel of a film. In fact, some of Hampton's article includes explanations of moments and scenes that were scripted but never shot for Blade Runner 2049, so that's fascinating stuff as well. There's also plenty more stuff from Hampton, Fancher, and David Webb Peoples regarding the original Blade Runner, including script excerpts that you could read that I researched at the Margaret Herrick Academy Library and the Writers Guild Foundation Library as well. In issue 29, you could also read the entire Blacklist screenplay Bare Knuckle, plus an interview with its writer, David Mateo. Issue 29 also features actor-writer Danny McBride and director David Gordon Green chatting about writing season 2 of HBO's darkly hilarious Vice Principals. We also have actor Jason Isaacs chatting about taking the captain's chair in Star Trek Discovery. Actor George Griffith on playing Rey in Twin Peaks, The Return. Directors Dayton Ferris on Battle of the Sexes. Director Andy Muschietti on the horror hit It. Screenwriter Jason Hall on Thank You for Your Service. And we'll even have a story on Thor Ragnarok, which will be updated into the issue when the film comes out into theaters. And so much more to explore. Remember, if you have an iPad or any tablet with Google Play, the app and issue 1 are both still free, and each individual issue costs less than a beer at a hipster bar. So treat yourself. Look, I really appreciate you considering to support my passion project going live soon at www.backstory.net, so thanks for checking it out. And of course, while you're surfing around online, don't forget to stop on over by today's sponsor, screencraft.org, and enter any of their programs or competitions with the 10% discount code QAPODCAST at screencraft.org. But now, let's jump right back into my conversation with James Mangold about his passion project, Logan.
Part of the brilliance of your script with Michael and Scott is how you handled exposition. Exposition is difficult for all writers, and you were just doing these funny punk rock things all throughout in which, you know, they're watching this video on the phone and the battery dies, and they got to find a charger so they can see the rest of it. You know, Xander at the end is starting to explain, oh, it's through Canewood.
It's blown away.
We put stud in corn. Right, his head's blown off. and then there was
I don't like exposition.
Right. I thought it was great. So was that something that you had to kind of sculpt?
Absolutely.
And go through a power of reduction so that you understand it?
Well, it's a very interesting thing. One of the things Scott did was this idea I was experimenting with different ways to set up Laura's story and how she comes into Logan's life. And it was really clear to all of us, the three of us writers working on it, that the second I was kind of tracking Laura and tracking Logan and cutting between them, the movie was already, again, starting to have this kind of epic round-robin feel. And so we really wanted to just let Laura, like a kind of myth, arrive in Logan's life and unravel it retroactively. And so then the challenge became how to go about doing that, how to kind of unravel the mystery and do it. And Scott came up with the idea of this kind of video document that this nurse, heroic nurse, had made of what had been going on, which then freed us from the first act having to kind of do a chronological story of her, which we also wrote. I mean, far as influential, even more specifically influential than Old Man Logan, was the X-23 comic book series and kind of the whole story of her creation.
Well, right. She was first in a comic called NYX.
No, and before that she was in, or maybe the order is wrong. But the one you might know better than me. The what is the one that create her origin story?
That came later, right?
Yeah,
And then also he has a son named Dakin, you know, Wolverine did. Yeah. So I mean, coming from this place of love, using X-23 totally made sense. What gave you the idea of having her as young as she is? Because in NYCX and some of the other stories, she's older. I like the younger girl version.
Yeah, I mean, there's every opportunity in the future to make a movie about her older.
Of course. I hope you do, buddy.
but for me, it was trying to get out of the CW of it all, the like hot, attractive, wise ass teenager hero. And I didn't want to, I thought Logan trapped with this kind of impetuous 16-year-old hot girl with claws was going to be nothing but a bunch of cliches I had seen before. And the idea of love, and again, getting back to that idea that what is Logan most frightened of? Love. An 11-year-old would need more from him than a 16-year-old.
It's funny that you're worried about the talky 16-year-old girl where you have X-23 as a mute for basically most of your movie. At what point did you decide to let her speak when she was going to come out of her shell?
Well, the idea was that she was kind of holding it in. But the other thing for us was this idea that even when she lets it out, it's in Spanish, meaning that one of the things that came from even working on the previous Wolverine in Japan was how interesting it is, how much more cinematic your movie becomes when you essentially make a movie in a place where people can't speak, where they're speaking different languages, and how it instantaneously forces the film to be a movie. As opposed to a recording of people talking. And that was really appealing to me and probably carried over. Plus, the idea that she had been raised south of the border, it just seemed to make sense. But the idea that he has this daughter who speaks Spanish, first won't speak and then speaks Spanish, to me was always promising because Logan is always most fun when he's being frustrated.
A classic part of Logan is that the people he loves and around him are always harmed. And you had another great left turn in the middle of the movie to just reinforce the Western tropes when literally he is forced off the road and helps this family with their horses.
Right.
When did that idea come into play? Because that was just another place that you would never expect this movie to go, but I'm glad it did.
It goes with the road. Like if there was any form besides the Western, it was kind of the road picture. And what defines the road picture is a kind of series, just like the Odyssey, the series of kind of adventures. I mean, even that would be true of Mark's Old Man Logan, that there's kind of a series of episodic, self-contained adventures. You meet new – it defines life on the road. It, instead of being about a kind of consistent set of characters, it becomes about a kind of movement through different places, meeting people, and then moving on. And many Westerns, 310 to Yuma, which I did, has very much that feeling. You start here, you move here, there's a Chinese work camp, then there's the village, the railhead you end up at, and then in each place you're introducing an entirely new cast along with your regulars. And so the farm family, the Munsons, was a chance, it was about eight things at once. It was a chance for the movie to have a kind of reprieve. After being fairly intense, and to give the audience a chance to breathe with these characters, a chance to give Logan and Charles a moment to be happy, and to feel the kind of tenderness in them with Laura, for Laura to see what a family looks like. She had never been out of a lab. This is the first moment. It was loaded with so many things and opportunities. A lot of the dialogue in that dinner scene, in fact, almost all of it, was improvised. And the... And then, of course, violence arrives. For me, one of the things I'm most fascinated with working on these larger scale movies is that they seem to always, you know, I've made dramas a lot of my life and kind of came into making these films sideways. And a lot of these films seem to me to be kind of suffering from kind of dramatic stiffness or untruthfulness sometimes, not all, or a kind of, I guess what I'm saying is I really interested in a film that is both really merciless and really tender, and that you could have the same thing in the same movie. And I don't see that often. And it's, to me, I see it in Westerns, but that you could have a film that has a really tender scene between a father and a daughter about what life is about and the people they've hurt. You could also have a scene of them killing the shit out of people. And that the and to try the challenge for me of trying to string those pearls on the same line.
And speaking of such tenderness, because this happens at the farmhouse, there's the death of Professor X.
Yes.
And it's not like a violent special effects blowout. It's X-24 just surprising the audience because, you know, it was left out of the marketing materials. Kudos to you on that. And it just, you know, there's confusion. Like, is Logan doing a mercy right. killing? What the hell is going on? And it's just like a you know, his hand against the chest.
Yeah.
When did you decide that Professor X was going to buy it here as well and arrive at that specific death?
Well, again, it's this kind of outline or how to, you know, what the idea occurred to me that we should have a kind of, that they've developed a kind of new Weapon X, a kind of clone of Logan, younger, healthier, like the one that he was, and without a conscience like he has. And so from that point, I then knew, okay, well, I have Hugh playing two parts. So now, cinematically, how do I take advantage of that?
And right, because you don't want it to be a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie with well, him versus
it. No, but the but at the same time, one of the cinematic ways to take advantage of that would be to kind of play a kind of shell game with the audience. You know, Logan goes out on a walk. Logan starts coming back. We cut back to Charles. Is this Logan entering the room? Who is it entering the room? And it's very intentional trying to play this kind of little bit of, I mean, confusion is an interesting tool to use. It's not something always to be avoided. That's why exposition is not always our friend. Sometimes the way to get an audience to lean into a movie is to make them a little confused. Just not too confused.
Well, you also did an interesting thing in which he kind of has a monologue about how this was the nicest night in a long time, but you didn't give him a death speech. You know, he's talking about the boat when he's dying in the truck at the end. And I'm just curious the kind of iterations that went through because...
Well, it's interesting. It's an interesting question. The part of the reason we gave him that speech where he has it is because for me, the sleight of hand of having X-24 walk in the room and kill him required that you get involved in something else. Meaning just like if I'm a magician and I'm going to saw someone in half, I have an assistant, you're looking at something he or she is doing over here, that in a sense... Patrick's monologue about what he's feeling is me getting you to look over here. So that but it's not irrelevant. It's deeply relevant to the character, but it's the scene's doing two things at the same time, getting you involved in the trope of a character monologue and pushing in on him as he talks, but also freeing me to not have to cover who's standing in the doorway. And because the trope of the kind of emotional monologue in a movie is the slow push in on the actor as they do their heartfelt performance. So you don't feel, or most of you probably don't feel the cheat because I'm delivering on something you recognize as kind of a standard Lego unit of movies. But it allows me to avoid looking at who's there.
I think one of the biggest things you got away with that was just beautiful for this, again, kind of upending the genre, was your lack of a central villain. You know, you could try and tag that Pierce in the beginning is going to be
sure.
him and his group. Maybe it's going to be Xander when he comes at the end, but he starts monologuing and it's not. It's really actually the darkest side of the protagonist as X-24. When did you realize that there was not going to be any big reveal of?
Well, that was the struggle, Jeff, with the kind of comic book ethos, meaning you're kind of like, if you're who's the villain of The Wrestler? Who's the villain of Little Miss Sunshine? Who's the villain of Paper Moon? Meaning that if you're making a character movie, write a character movie. And one of the aspects of a character film is that it's about relationships and there isn't Dr. Diabolical anywhere. You know, it is kind of about our relationships with one another. And so, that was the biggest thing to attend to in working on the film was trying to avoid this natural thing to go, who's our big villain? Who's the bad guy? Who's the da-da-da? And I personally, as a writer, hate those terms. Like, there is no bad guy. There is an antagonist and a protagonist. But, like, the antagonist thinks he's doing good shit, not bad shit. So there really is no bad guy. No one wakes up very rarely and goes, how can I do something heinous today? They actually think they're doing something positive. Even the most heinous acts are twisted in people's minds into being positive.
Which Xander, in the end, as he's trying to explain himself away, thinks he's doing just this great thing by, you know, controlling the mutants, per se.
Just like we do when we spray roaches. But we're murdering. It's just, you can find anything to justify anything. People will find, there's, you know, go to a, we all eat burgers, go to the abattoir where they're killed. Meaning there's murder. We're all okay with some kinds of killing and not okay with others. And that's very cultural. But the, so it's like this bad guy, good guy thing when you're writing is really good thing to avoid because it means you write like just psychotic villains.
But thematically, you're also dealing with the darkest side of your protagonist,
really. Of course.
So, so that
but
was
we
the
all
beauty.
Have dark sides. Right. Meaning, yes.
No, yeah. And that was beauty because because it is him. It's, you know, it's his DNA, literally.
Absolutely.
Not a metaphor. The final death scene, you know, for Wolverine. I mean, that's a big moment. That's something that people are leaning forward in their seats on. And I'm just kind of curious some of the iterations that you went through on that, arriving to that moment where really, really Laura is kind of coming into her own. She's saving him. She's as fierce as he is. And the kids as well. So that it really wasn't Wolverine... It really wasn't Wolverine's strength so much that was helping that group as it was his leadership to kind of motivate them to fight back.
That's true. And also for Laura, particularly just the idea that he cares about her. I mean, the idea
because he abandons her so many different times in the movie to,
yes.
to go for Professor.
I mean,
Professor.
He's trying to get rid of her. I mean, he literally is like dumping her. I mean, he's trying to get in the car and drive away. He leaves her at Charles's grave. I mean, it's completely specious what he's doing, but to me it's what's so beautiful about his character is you understand he can't deal, he can't love, he has to run from it, he's terrified of it, he just lost Charles, he can't lose anyone else, he can barely function through that loss, so that we forgive him, meaning what he's doing by any standard is horrible, but we forgive him. But it's really, but in the end of the movie, and this again would be as much of a sketch as I ever had, he comes back. And the idea for me about how to survive killing him and not, because I really don't believe that it's nice to invite people to a movie and then hit him in the head with a hammer, that it would be, is there a way to allow Wolverine to die that we can have some kind of peace with or a kind of positive feeling about as well as negative, and what I felt would be the one thing is if the very thing he was most frightened of in the final seconds of his life opened up for him.
Right, because everything comes down to that moment at the tree that he's impaled on and Laura.
Just holding his daughter's hand and feeling love and being unfettered by fear of it, by fear of what the villain is doing or anything else, by just that veil lifting, and he feels for the, if he's lived 200 years, for the last 30 seconds, he gets to exalt in something he's never once felt. And that the love of a child, the pure love of a child, the devotion of a child, the sense that he is living on through her, and the sense that they're connected. And that to me, if we could nail that moment, and it was much more about the talking about it than writing it, was to somehow craft it so that somehow that alchemy happened for Hugh in that moment.
How long was your production schedule? How long did you get to shoot?
72 days, something like that.
Editing's the last stage of storytelling. What were some of the lessons in editing? Because you got away with a 2-hour and 20-minute movie, which says a lot. And I'm curious what your lessons were in editing, and if you ever had to fight anybody about that kind of runtime.
The studio was a dream on this movie. I have to say that there was never any kind of big battle on this film. It was really just shaping performance and carving out and pace and kind of, you know, it's a challenging film in the sense that it isn't for the. It isn't, you know, ADD theater. It does take its time, you know, and that's part of it being a character film. And I knew that given what it is, that some people are going to be arriving with a sense of the kind of upcut nature of what it could be, and that I couldn't deliver that and the other. So it was, I think most of what happened in the cutting room was trying to find that balance, pacing balance, in which we could deliver and give real moments of life for the characters and give the performers a little bit of space to find the words.
Were there any scenes that were tough to cut? Something that was kind of long that you just realized that the film was going to move
the
better?
The Munson house, the amount of performance bays, the murder, that farmhouse and what goes on was really tricky. You've got the father and Logan going out and having this experience in the cornfield and running into those corporate farmers. You have Charles going to bed, and Laura meeting the other young boy at the house and getting the earbuds and kind of walking off with them. You have the arrival of the villains in the convoy. You have X-24 arriving in the room. You have Logan then arriving back with the father, who runs upstairs, gets killed, discovers Charles has been murdered, running him to a pickup truck while the cowboys out for the corporate cowboys are getting killed by X-24.
It's a lot.
Meanwhile, in the van, Pearson, meaning that was not just a lot to edit, but a lot to manage the shooting of. It looks in some ways deceptively simple, but the amount of performance space and cross-cutting in that was a bear. It was a real bear.
And it moved right along. Geeky question.
Sure.
And then a personal question or two, and then we'll get something from the crowd. Who was the woman on the radio telling the kids where to cross? Some people have wondered if it's Heather Hudson, Wolverine's ex-girlfriend, who once found him in the woods, because she's of Alpha Flight,
I have no idea who Heather Hudson is.
Well, she's of the Canadian Avengers, kind of,
with
Maple Leaf and all them.
Maple Leaf?
Yes, if you could believe such a character exists.
I don't.
So it's not Heather Hudson?
No.
Who is on the radio? Do you know who it is?
A French lady.
French lady? All right. French Canadian. All right. That tells us something. What was your most personal moment, in all seriousness? Because you're doing a
making
film.
Making the film?
Yeah. No, just in the film. A moment that you're really happy about that was in the script or in the direction that has a personal meaning to you, even though you are technically adapting someone else's IP. What was a moment that you were able to make personal for you?
There was a great many. I mean, I love the scene, which I wrote in the pickup truck, where he's explaining to her that people wrote these and it's not real. It's something like it happened, but not like this. And the stuff that Scott and I did back at the hotel in Oklahoma City, where he's like, kind of, look what we got here, a Wolverine fan. I find that I'm really proud of that, because I feel like we wouldn't have solved the movie if we hadn't gotten that piece. But there, in terms of things that move me, I love that scene between Laura and Logan, which was one, again, I'm more attached to the things that were very early ideas, and one where he wakes up in a nightmare and he asks her if she ever has nightmares, and she says, yes, people hurt me. And he says, mine are different. I hurt people. And that to me, that scene was a kind of cutting to then she pulls out the bullet and he tries to bullshit her about all these reasons he was carrying the bullet, and then just admits to his 11-year-old daughter that he was trying to kill himself with it. And that scene, the delicacy of that scene, the beauty of what young Daphne Keene could, the kind of gravity she had to own that space with you in that scene. And I also love the moment where she kind of tries to almost keep up with that and admit that she's hurt people too. And he says, you're going to have to learn to live with that. There was to me, that's a very Western influenced scene, a kind of, and a loving scene from my perspective about this character.
What was your toughest scene? And then we'll get a few from the crowd, because I know we're
toughest
running out of time.
To write, toughest.
Your toughest both to write and to direct. And how did you creatively solve the challenge? The scene that you were kind of nervous the most about and you kept coming back to again and again, what was your toughest scene on the page?
I don't know. Honestly, I think that the one I returned to over and over again and was kind of the Rosetta Stone for me in the movie was the first scene with Charles and Logan in the tank. And I would always go to that scene when I didn't know what else to work on, because it seemed like it was the scene in which the world got set in place. But in terms of hardest, I mean, like, this was a script where we had a hard time figuring out exactly how the cards were all going to play out in the end. But it was very, once we had committed to a lot of these assumptions about the characters, they were actually a dream to write. You know, like you just sit down and go, okay, so now Logan is half dead, driving to North Dakota with a 11-year-old in the car who's quite healthy, and he's collapsing, and so she's going to take the wheel, and he's going to be like, no, and you're going to have this kind of, meaning those scenes would write themselves, and those were very easy. The tough part was just kind of making sure we knew our way through.
Yeah, there was good poetry in that scene, the first scene between Charles and Wolverine, because it almost looks like a weird version of Cerebro as they're inside this tank,
yes,
this circle.
Well, that was intentional.
In the noir version, your black and white version, the pins of light coming
are
through.
Are even more exaggerated. Yeah,
yeah. It was beautiful. So then what was your toughest scene to direct?
I mean, the ones that you could say the tough ones are the dramatic ones, but I love it. That's my stock and trade. I love getting kind of knee-deep with the actors and solving those scenes. I get nervous, you know, before them. Will we deliver? Can we do it? I don't rehearse a lot. I try and kind of make the moments happen for the first time on camera. So in a way, the toughest to me is the action stuff is just requires tremendous patience. Getting the kind of one, you know, there's some of those sequences are hundreds of cuts, and so
and do you direct all those rather than have
most,
a second unit?
Most, I mean, there's times when it's just I don't want to spend an entire day watching a car spin out, so we'll send someone out to do that.
Sure,
but the like that whole. Sequence at the smelting plant. No, we shot that. We didn't have an elaborate second unit on the movie. I don't like it, meaning I think it produces a kind of a look and feel, a kind of...
That's separate from the main, from the A
It's
a
separate,
unit.
And it's also, it's not in a style. It becomes, you hire someone who directs it, they set up the battery of three cameras, they do the one that's in the ditch with the car going over it, they do the mount inside the car, they do the ding. You get this kind of pro forma set of shots that is kind of the menu, the du jour menu of kind of what second unit directing is these days or any other day. And that to me, the success in movies of action is going back to the beginning of movies has always been that the action speaks of character. That the action isn't just movement, but that, for instance, to use your example of the limo hitting the fence and the fence doesn't break, that physical action is used to be specific to this movie, that it couldn't be any movie, that this movie has a specific thing to say in relation to its action, and trying to find that originality out.
Let's take a few from the crowd.
Sure.
His parents love the movie and they don't like comic book movies. And his question is, of course, comic related, in which he just wants to hear a little more about the device of using comics in the movie. One of the great things that you did in it was actually you did the kind of if you build it, they will come moment in which although it's a fake part of the comic, these map coordinates, they lead to somewhere and all the kids know about them. So although it was from someone's imagination at Marvel, presumably in this universe, it still is a real salvation for them of sorts.
Right.
And strangely, there is someone telling them to go over the border who's French now, we know.
Yes, well,
speaks
you can
French,
hear that.
Speaks French, yes.
Yeah.
So talk about that with the comic.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, there was a whole bunch of things that touch came from. One was, and I'm not sure which was first, but we needed, I mean, literally, I remember just beating out things with Scott pacing around in a hotel one day and trying to figure out how does Laura know where she needs to go? Why? How does she know where, what is this, we need a destination. You know, 310 to Yuma, you have to get to the 310 to Yuma. Well, in this movie, where are you trying to get and why? And the idea that the goal or the place they have to go would be something that Logan looks at as farcical was really helpful to writing Logan, meaning so that the mechanics of having a child saying, take me here, and him going, it's bullshit. No, it's bullshit, you know, and that's more interesting than him going, I don't want to go there, or meaning that his relationship to the goal of the film and the movement forward of the film becomes one of that's more interesting, if you will. But it was also shaped by other stuff. Like, I can't tell you what's first or second. In Unforgiven, which was also a huge influence on Mark's text and on us as well. Isn't it Richard Harris who's following around writing all these Western novels about gunslingers like Eastwood? And Richard Harris is a gunslinger and that other guy is running around writing a story about him. I don't remember what it is, but I remember there's someone writing like Western novels.
And they're exaggerating is the important
part. Yes, and they're exaggerating. And then lastly, I was, for all my I don't care about the greater universe, I knew that I'd be hit with these questions and that I wanted a context for the audience to be able to place the other X-Men films and everything else in some... I knew I needed to give people some framework or there'd just be too many traumatized fans. So that the framework for me was that the fetishized X-Men world that you're used to is perhaps the world in these comics, whereas the world you're looking at right now is something a little less shiny and a little less fantastical and a little more human. and not entirely different. They are the same people, but it is just – it's just this is what it might really look like if they really had to drive a car and get to work and get food when they're hungry and wake up hungover, as opposed to the kind of the glossier depiction, which in a way the comic books gave me a kind of, or the audience, a kind of prism with which to allocate the other movies to if they needed it.
And that link to Unforgiven totally makes sense. I mean, yeah. that's a brilliant nod. Right there, you, sir, I'm sorry, the LA Film School student right there, yeah.
I had an advantage. You're asking, he's asking, I could do it. He's asking, what was it like pitching this movie?
You got it.
Okay. So why had an advantage pitching the movie to the studio, which is that Hugh really wasn't going to do it if I wasn't going to do it. And I wasn't going to do it if they didn't do what we wanted.
And you'd made a Wolverine movie before.
So we kind of just had them over a barrel. We were like, we want to make it rated R. Or you cannot have, or the last one could be the last one, you know. Or so if you want to do this one, we'd like to do it rated R. We'd like to do this. We'd like to, you know, we kind of laid it out. But we also told them the story. And to their credit, I think one of the things happening even in the executive ranks is that, you know, they recognize that the $250 million plus movie that even they can barely watch, that may be attracting enough 11-year-olds to justify its cost, but is not quite making what it used to make. They know the formula is getting stale. So there is, if someone's saying, I'll make it for half the price and do something different, that's not necessarily frightening to them, because the other frightening thing is spending $250 million and just making a kind of ditto of last year's movie over again, with the entire cast charging them three times more for the participation, and the costs are just going out of the roof. So that the idea of doing something more intimate had appeal for the studio as well.
Our sound recordist Jackson has a question.
No, we just thought it would be great.
The Johnny Cash song.
We just thought it would be great at the end. And obviously, I have a special. I mean, I knew Johnny Cash, so I have a kind of my own devotion to him is so for me there was a kind of, and John and Logan are very similar characters. You know, one of the things that John Cash told me when I was working on Walk the Line that never made it into the movie but was very moving to me was this, you know, only a few weeks before he died, I was asking him, we kept talking because he liked to talk about his life, and I had kind of had the screenplay pretty licked, but I asked him what his favorite movie was. And John said the movie that had made the biggest impression on him was James Whale's Frankenstein. And he said, because when he saw it in Mississippi when he was 9 or 10, it scared the shit out of everyone in the audience, but he wasn't scared. And he thought he felt like he connected with the creature. And he told me that, you know, when I was 9, I felt like I was made up of all the bad parts of bad people. And hearing John at a very late moment in his life saying that, you realize the kind of weight he lived all his life, even since childhood, kind of feeling ashamed and bad inside. But that's a profound connection to Logan also, who has gone through his whole life in a sense feeling broken and violent and dangerous and unlovable.
In the red shirt, you sir, right there, how does it make you feel that a superhero film, particularly Logan, could be nominated as one of the 10 next year, which would be a huge accomplishment?
From your lips, but as far as I'm concerned, I'm thrilled. I'm honestly really thrilled with what's happened with the movie. I really... You know, it's a pretty out there film, and ends on a gravestone. And that the idea that it made over $600 million and ends with a dead hero and a bunch of orphan kids wandering into the woods is pretty is kind of amazing. And to me, that's really adequate reward. And I also think that the whole thing is kind of self-created. You know, Ben-Hur was a superhero movie. So is The Story of Jesus Christ. And so is Gladiator is a superhero movie. So it's all so much of the way the awards industry and the entertainment press, they, not unlike the political press, they create scandals and boundaries and things to write stories about, and then we worry about them. But it's like, what is a comic book movie? A movie based on a comic book? Then why isn't every movie based on a novel called a novel movie? It's also stupid, really, because there's as many kind of comic books, adult, Archie, Marvel, DC. I mean, like, it all is just source material, as is everything. And so all these divisions are really things created by people generally to make money, and that the reality is that there's been plenty of superhero or comic book movies that have gotten awards before, but it's a way of slumming them or putting a pejorative on them now that is silly, because I think bad films should not be rewarded, and good films and ambitious films should be honored wherever they can, hopefully.
Yeah, and they're turning around. And, like, Guardians of the Galaxy was the first Marvel movie to ever get a nomination by the Writers Guild. So, I mean, like, things are turning around.
I love that film. Yeah. It was also – it had a great energy.
And it upended a lot of things in the genre.
Absolutely.
It came out of nowhere. You know, as we're running out of time, people could – you know, he'll be signing posters for a minute or two, so you could ask another question then. But was there ever a version where, you know, the rocks on his grave started lifting off and everybody realized all their moms were named Martha? No, I'm joking. Look, here's my big question. Where are you with X-23? What could you tell us about another possible movie that I would hope you'd be involved with, or what are you working on next? Are you going to take a break?
We're working on a story for a continuation of Laura, and I'm working on it, but I'm not making one of these movies next. I'm telling you now.
So you're going to write it? And not directed, or
I'm working on the script right now with Craig Kyle, but my next movie will not be a movie involving anybody with any powers.
Do you know what your next film is? Do you have something lined up?
I can't tell you now.
Okay. Well, look, you have been very generous with your time. You upended a genre, and I love it. Give it up again for good old James.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And that's how the Q&A went down. Special thanks again to co-writer-director James Mangold for spending time chatting about his latest film, Logan. Of course, also special thanks to our sponsor, ScreenCraft.org. Don't forget you could use exclusive coupon code QAPODCAST to save 10% off any of their programs or competitions in 2017 or 2018. So head on over to ScreenCraft.org and check it out. The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith is a copyright of Unlikely Films Incorporated in 2017. All rights reserved. And folks, I gotta thank you again for spreading the word about issue 29, our Blade Runner 2049 issue. And of course, get ready to read the entire magazine soon at backstory.net. And hey, if you'd like to show your support and donate to this free podcast so I can continue to buy new equipment and use these funds to pay for all my podcast hosting fees, feel free to send a PayPal virtual tip to yogoldsmith@gmail.com. Any amount is greatly appreciated. As for your social networking needs, you could follow Yo Goldsmith on Twitter or could check out my Facebook fan page. I'm Jeff Goldsmith, the publisher of Backstory and the host of the Q&A, thanking you for tuning in and telling you to stay out of trouble. Till next week.